You're listening to The Big Interview, first broadcast on the 31st of January 2016 on Monocle 24.
Hello, I'm Tyler Brûlé, and this is The Big Interview here on Monocle 24, our one-on-one series where people with sharp ideas, enviable experiences, and usually a good setup in both business and pleasure sit down and tell us how they honed their craft, managed through the dark hours, and view the world around them. Joining me in studio in London today is Matthias Dupfner, the CEO of Berlin-based media powerhouse Axel Springer. Born in Bonn in 1963, Dupfner has done an extensive tour through the editorial floors, TV studios, and boardrooms of not just Germany's biggest publishers, but also a host of major international corporates, overseeing a portfolio of media brands that includes Bild-Zeitung, Die Welt, the rolling news service N24, and the recently acquired US-based Business Insider. Dupfner has transformed Axel Springer into one of Europe's most nimble and progressive media companies, despite losing a high-profile bid to take over the Financial Times late in the summer of 2015. With a substantial war chest for new acquisitions and a very clear vision of how to integrate TV, print, digital, commerce, and more, 2016 should be a busy year for a man just named as Germany's most respected CEO. Matthias Dupfner, welcome to The Big Interview. We're slightly into 2016, not too far in so far, but if you look back at 2015, an interesting year. I think if we look at the back end of summer, everyone thought you were poised to make a very interesting purchase in this town in the form of the Financial Times. But you picked up another interesting business title or business brand in terms of Business Insider. How did 2015 sort of feel to you in terms of a media year? Was it a turning point? Because at some turn, I sort of felt it was a bit of a settling down, that everyone sort of became at peace in terms of what was going to be digital, what's going to be print. And from, I guess, a Springer point of view, or from a Dupfner's point of view, how did you see it?
Well, I think the year 2015 was in many ways turning point, a pivotal year. First of all, of course, with regard to the role that terrorism plays in Europe, but we may come to that topic later. From a media company perspective, I think, to me, it has basically clarified that the ultimate fight, the ultimate defense, is not the defense of newspapers or magazines on paper, that it is really about newspaper journalism, about professional journalism, about branded content. That is the thing that needs to be saved. That is what needs to be preserved. And I think the year 2015 has shown clearly there is this mega trend that the young audience is more and more focused on digital media only. And I think the big lesson learned from that is let's embrace and shape that future. I mean, in the case of Axel Springer, with all humbleness, I'd say we have learned that lesson already much earlier, but I think it became a kind of broader consensus in 2015.
We can talk about digital and get very excited about it, but I speak to publishers in magazines and newspapers, and everyone talks about the great growth and how they're building subscriptions, and they've got, of course, you know, more people who are looking at their sites. But at the same time, from a revenue point of view, we have agencies who are only interested in clicks, who are only interested in traffic, and we see so many media brands, even respected state broadcasters, who still have, of course, sidebars dealing with cats and dog stories. And somehow these two things don't square for me, this drive that we need to have clicks and traffic, and at the same time we want to talk about great journalism.
There's no contradiction. I think the explanation for that is we are still in a very early stage of a development. We are in the founding years of digital journalism. And if you compare that to the, let's say, founding years of magazines and newspapers, it was also quality-wise a lot different. There was a lot of user-generated content. It was mainly written by readers. There was not a really sustainable business model inside. So I think those are the typical signs of a beginning. And I think it's very exciting to shape this now. And if you have a more pessimistic view, a kind of cultural pessimism, then you'd say, okay, media as we know them, professional journalists, professional content is going to be replaced by either only user-generated content or by only big platforms like the GAFA companies who are organizing the world distribution of decentrally produced content that is mainly produced by companies or entities that have a commercial interest or a political interest. That is the pessimistic view. Then this is almost the end of the world, in any case, the end of the publishing world, and with that, perhaps the end of democracy. I don't believe that at all. I think we have a very, very exciting future ahead of us. I think what we see now is the development of a completely new era of media companies. And if you take the new players, take the big ones, Vice Media, Vox Media, BuzzFeed, Huffington Post, yeah, of course, BuzzFeed used to be a kind of pet photo thing. Now they are hiring, with a lot of money that they got from their investors, they're hiring professional journalists, great journalists. And we don't know, perhaps in 5 years, in 10 years, it may be a serious source of information and entertainment. So I would not underestimate it. I think the digital native publishers have the potential to replace step by step the legacy publishers that we know today. And that's why I think we, the publishers, the journalists, we really have to define what is the fundament of our business, what is our raison d'être. I definitely think it's not to print something on paper. It is really to investigate and write the best possible stories. And if that's our business model, it's a little bit like during the days when the automobile has been invented. If you thought your job is to use horses for transportation, then you are facing near death. If you think that your business model is transportation, then you have a great future.
What specifically over the last 5 years, 7 years, has Axel Springer figured out in this digital space and what is happening? Are there two or three house secrets that you would say that, yes, these were decisions, these were bets that you took that have really come good?
There are absolutely no house secrets. And I think it's all a lot simpler than it may look like. People ask me, how could you foresee already in the year 2000 that this digital revolution is happening? And how have you been able to shape the company and transform it into a digital company? To be honest, I think that's not the question. The question is why so many other publishers didn't see it. It was so obvious. And it's totally clear that you never can change progress or can avoid progress. You can only shape it and try to take advantage. So I think it was pretty obvious that digitization is going to change a lot. And it was very obvious that it's going to change the music industry and the publishing industry fundamentally. And so we have, over the years, step by step, with a lot of learning experiences, with a lot of pain, with a lot of cultural hiccups, I have to say, but we have developed a culture that is embracing that progress, that is very change-oriented. We have, in a way, a very well-trained change muscle, which is important because the innovation cycles are getting shorter and shorter. And we have made some decisions how to do that transformation. And the three most important are no fear for self-cannibalization, because you get cannibalized anyway, so better you do it yourself. Second is no silos. Don't try to separate so-called old media people from new media people, because then you create winners and losers, and we want to have winners only. And the third paradigm in our company is no integration in the classical sense, like usually big corporations do it. So deal with startups as really independent companies with independent cultures and with real entrepreneurs who have to be treated like entrepreneurs. And we hope that we live that.
Does a German media company sit in a luxurious place just because it's German? And by this, I mean sometimes Germany's a little bit slower. Germany's a little bit more considered. Yeah. And we can also look at the media landscape and we see that the highway, the information highway, whatever it is a little bit littered with the carcasses of many pioneers who invested too much too early. And we can look at the media landscape in Germany and see that there are still many winners, and partly because there is a dose of conservatism. But oftentimes conservatism is seen as a bad thing.
Well, in that case, it is, I have to admit, I think, because if you are too late, you will lose it. Of course, you can also be too early. So timing is of the essence, I agree. And in a way, Germany is a bit later in the development stages than, for example, the United States or than the United Kingdom. Why is that so? Because Germany has traditionally a very, very a strong regional newspaper landscape. We have 360 independent regional newspaper publishers and much more papers and thousands of magazines. So it is a very, very diverse and in the regions a very powerful infrastructure. Some of the regional newspaper publishers used to be sales billionaires. They had very high margins. They had almost monopolistic, luxurious market positions. And that, of course, in a way helps to survive longer or to perhaps even ignore a change longer. But I think the fundamental underlying trends are intact and they are also given in Germany. I don't see any reason why things would be in the long run different. They may get obvious a little later, but they are absolutely true in Germany as well. But it's true. We have a lot of strong brands. We have a lot of great journalists, and that is a treasure that we definitely should cherish. And the big, big goal is now to really make sure that this quality is not only going to survive in the digital world, that it's even getting better, that we really have the golden times of journalism ahead of us and not behind of us.
Can Germany take a leadership position in that case? Because the global narrative is so much led by the U.S., and I guess more so by one coast than the other now, some of it led out of the UK. But what happens on the editorial floor or in the offices of the Herausgeber in Germany, where you think, there maybe are some cues that Australians or Japanese or certainly British companies could learn from the setup of German publishing or media houses?
We should be extremely careful.
I know.
Germany,
I know we're venturing into
telling
different.
The world
I know.
What to
I
do
know. But anyway, here's an opportunity.
I get it. I get it in the right sense. And truly, I mean, if you compare it with America, I have to say that at least some of the European and with that some of the German publishers are doing better, are more innovative, are embracing change and innovation better than their American peers. Why is that so? Because I think in the U.S. it is so easy to simply launch a new business and become a founder and do something new and disruptive. In Germany, that is a lot more bureaucratic, a lot more difficult. That's why it makes more sense to transform an existing business. Instead of just closing it down and do something new, you better transform it. And I think that helped German publishers to do some great things. In general, I think what we really should develop, and some of our colleagues in Germany and we ourselves are trying to do that, that is that we should be distribution channel agnostic. I think this, to a certain degree, I think this whole religious debate, print against online and website against mobile and so on, these religious fights are a little old-fashioned, I think. Yeah, if I look to my three young boys, ranging from 10 to 19 years, of course, most of the news consumption is on their mobile devices, but they also use websites, they also use magazines, they also use newspapers in certain situations, and they read books. So I think it's more about that. Let's focus on the content quality, on the journalistic quality, and then simply play it out on various distribution channels.
When you talk to advertisers, do you use your boys often as perhaps symbols of what this modern media landscape looks like? Because I think it's very rare for someone to say, I mean, you were certainly talking about the first bit, my children are all over their mobile devices. But I feel that there's just a lot of deaf ears that don't want to hear about young people picking up a magazine. I mean, I know that so oftentimes I go into music, do 18-year-olds really buy Monocle? Like, absolutely. I mean, there's a post-magazine generation who have been living on digital and suddenly they pick up something which is different paper stocks, and it's a completely different experience for them.
Yeah, and we have to be, I mean, we simply have to be realistic. It's to just defend print, I think, is not a case that you can make. But to cherish the possibilities of print that are different from digital media and to try to really produce overwhelmingly creative products on paper that could never be produced on digital distribution channels, and with that reach also young target groups, that's an absolutely realistic case. And let's take the music industry. Vinyl records have a kind of revival. I mean, they are never getting to economic relevance of the digital models, but they are there, and they're getting bigger, and they have a community that loves it. And I think the same will be the case for magazines, for newspapers, for print products. And we just have to be creative.
You're with The Big Interview here on Monocle 24. My guest today is Matthias Dupfner, CEO of the media house Axel Springer Verlag. We're going away for a short break. Stay with us.
Monocle's unrivaled network of editors and correspondents around the world bring you a brilliant new collection of books, the Monocle Travel Guides, and the series kicks off with New York and with London. London can be a big beast to tame, even for the people who get to call it home, but this ever-changing and regenerating capital can also charm you with its beauty. The Monocle Travel Guide to London is a celebration of all the things that the Monocle team loves about this mighty metropolis, and they're brave enough to let you see the wrinkles too. London's a global city, but the Monocle team will help you see it as a series of friendly local gems, with this guide to the shops, restaurants, music venues and museums we think should edge their way onto your itinerary. Whether it's a mid-morning run along the South Bank, the best Greek meal at Lemonia in Primrose Hill, or a handcrafted umbrella from London Undercover, our fresh ideas will leave you with a clear, crisp view of the capital. Published by Gestalten, these books are for people who want to get the most out of their stay, however short, and feel like locals rather than tourists. Pick up the Monocle Travel Guide to London in Monocle shops at monocle.com and in all good bookstores. The Monocle Travel Guides. Cities are fun. Let's explore.
You're back with a big interview here on Monocle 24 with me, Tyler Brulé, and my guest today, Matthias Dufner, the CEO of the media powerhouse Axel Springer. Who would have thought we would have been at a place where German media companies are so powerful internationally? I mean, Australia wouldn't really have a magazine business if it wasn't for your friends at Bauer at the moment, the way you're venturing into the US. And then, of course, we have our friends at Nikkei as well and what's happened there.
But here I have an explanation.
Okay, good.
Let's say a thesis.
Sure.
Yeah, perhaps it's not an explanation, but a thesis. That may be completely wrong. But Germany is, because of its geographical position, surrounded by neighbors, surrounded by other countries, by other languages. In contrast to, for example, the United States. They basically live under the impression what works in New York works in the rest of the world. Not always. The sensitivity for different cultures is key if it's about internationalization. And here I think the Austrians, the Swiss, the Germans, to take three German-speaking countries, have a lot of, let's say, almost geographically driven sensitivity for other languages, for other cultures, and a lot of respect for other cultures. In any case, in our company, this is what I'm basically preaching all the day if it is about internationalization. I said, we need to have a credible respect for other cultures, for the specifics of other nations, and we definitely cannot think that we can just implement the German model. So I think because of its geography, maybe even also a bit because of its history, that also created a kind of additional sensitivity for that, because we got world famous for exactly the opposite, that a dictator thought and the population thought they can teach the world and they can conquer the world. Today, I think that is in the modern Germany really the other way around, and that may help for a sensitive and successful internationalization.
Mm. Business Insider, were you looking at that for a while, or was it just there was cash in your pocket and you thought, okay, let's pick something up?
Oh, no. We were looking into it for quite a while. We were always amazed by the growth and by the journalistic quality and the storytelling that Henry Blodgett and his team has developed. So we watched it for quite a while. Then we made a small investment of roughly 10%. We were overwhelmed by the performance and also by the spirit of internal discussions. So it is one of the rare cases where the more you know about something, the more you are an insider, the more you love it. It's very often the other way around. Neighbor's grass is always greener. In that case, it got greener after we owned a piece of it. So we said, actually, that would be great to own it completely. And the original idea was, in a way, to link it with the Financial Times to benefit from the great brand and content quality of the FT and use this unique pipeline of the biggest global reach in business information that Business Insider has achieved. And so we were basically following these projects in parallel. Since we failed in acquiring the FT, we then were a lucky buyer of Business Insider and are happy to own it now together with Jeff Bezos.
Now, you mentioned that you like to leave startups, and I guess, you know, Business Insider is beyond being a startup in a way. But an investment like that, is it also to have a bit of a hothouse where you think I can find good talent in there and maybe someone needs to be parachuted into Berlin, etc.
Is absolutely a role, but to be very honest with you, as a kind of innovation center or hothouse, this is a bit too expensive. So we have to, I mean, it plays that role because there is a lot of innovation and we learn a lot from them and benefit on various fronts. Hopefully also the other way around. For example, what we did in Germany with ad blockers has been immediately adapted by Business Insider. So it goes in both directions. But yes, clearly it is a digital native publisher. For us, it is not only an innovation hub, but it is also a cornerstone of a US strategy or of an Anglo-Saxon strategy. And we think among the potential alternatives that we had in that space, I think Business Insider, with its very clear focus on business, and again, with its great editorial talent, I think that is always key. I mean, the older I get, I worked for 20 years as a journalist, and when I became a manager, I thought, okay, now you have to learn the language of managers, and it's all about marketing, it's all about technology, it's all about
distribution. Once a journalist, always a journalist,
all
right?
About the buzzwords. And then I found out, I can trust my old gut feeling. In the end, it's all about journalism.
Absolutely. Hear, hear. Tell me, I just want to go back to, I guess, how one looks at a traditional landscape. You have, of course, a very big, robust, respected newsroom with Die Welt. You also have alongside N24, 24-hour news channel. Will we see more integration there? Because I've always thought that this is something that you're missing. I mean, when I look back at the days of CNN in its heyday with AOL, mm-hmm. Yeah, we saw them trying to pull Time in. They tried to pull Fortune in, but these flagship shows never quite worked. And I always thought that, you know, then you saw the New York Times had investments in television, but they never quite did it. So maybe it's been published in an annual report somewhere already what will happen. But is, I guess, two questions. Is there, will we see more integration? And is there even room to take this brand and the power of it to even go beyond German language?
Two times yes. As I said earlier, I'm very skeptical about integration in the classical sense of the word. Buy a startup and then integrate it until a point, up to a point where it loses its charisma, it loses its soul, and it's then going to die. So we are very careful here. But in the case of N24 and Die Welt, the original idea was the idea of integration. And in the sense that we believe in the triangle of video content and online and print. And we think that these three elements have to play into each other's hands in a very natural way that really can go so far to have a joint newsroom. And that's what we are doing at the moment. We are fully integrating N24 and Die Welt Online into 24-hour written and video content information powerhouse. And in that case, both entities, the colleagues from Die Welt and the colleagues from N24, really loved that idea from the very beginning. So it's one of the very few cases where you don't have to force your employees and where you do it because you want to create the so-called synergies, which means in most of the cases just cut jobs and costs. That was not the idea. We are investing. Yeah, we are hiring more people, but we are doing it this fully integrated way. And that's very motivating for the team. It takes some time. We started already. You see a lot of N24 stuff on Welt websites. It can be the video content tool for many websites of the company. And yes, it could also be used with its big network of correspondents that now got bigger because every correspondent of the Welt print is now with a lot of passion also a correspondent for the TV channel. So with that network, you can also create something that can be used for international brands. And is to a certain degree already today on a very small level, but I think that definitely can grow.
Mm. And will it sound different when it hits international screens than Deutsche Welle?
Well, of course, if we would use N24 content for international brands, we would not use the brand of N24. It's just the content that it uses. If we would establish new brands, launch new brands with all that content that we generate, then we would create new brands as we do in the case of Update, which is this product that we have produced for Samsung and which will be pre-installed on Samsung flagship devices on the S7 as a first step in France, in England, in Germany and in Poland. Mm. So that's also an example where content and partly also video content from us, but also from hundreds of other publishers, is going to be integrated in such a product. And yeah, it really depends on how you use it, under a new brand name, under a different brand name that already exists, or simply for that group that I think has a lot of potential to become the leading quality journalism brand.
When you survey the global media landscape, who do you respect? Who do you think is getting it right? And I think people can talk about numbers and traffic, and that is a measure of getting it right. But oftentimes has nothing to do with anything that looks remotely like profit.
You can mention the New York Times. You can mention the Wall Street Journal. You can mention to a certain degree the FT with a paid offering that they have so successfully implemented. There are some super brands that are doing well. But if I'm looking to the big legacy companies, only very few are really positioned in a way that I would take a bet they are going to exist or they're going to prosper in 10 or 20 years from now. The players that I take most serious are really the digital native publishers. And here also some young companies like Mike.com. I mean, Mike.com, a company where we are also invested with a minority, they have done an interview with President Obama, and the reach within the millennial target group was significantly higher than the reach that the CNN interview with Obama got. And I think examples like that, young companies that are really focusing on true journalism, I think that is very encouraging. Or new models like Now This, a video company in New York that is doing short form video. Mm. I was surprised to talk to these people because they are really talking about a story. It's not that they're talking about algorithms or that they're talking about marketing. They are talking like the editors of the golden old days of a magazine like Spiegel or Stern or Time or Newsweek. They're really talking about what is the language, what is our style, what is our worldview, what is a good story for us. And I think that is very, very encouraging. So I would take these players most serious. I don't believe that the tech monopolies are taking it over completely. I think that's not going to work. And then I take very serious small niche players who are focusing in a very small area on an either very special interest content or also on a certain worldview or position that you take. Monocle is an example of that, I have to say.
Dankeschön. Just before we go, we started talking about the importance of the quality of journalism head off. And I'm wondering, how does that message then transmit to the brand or maybe the agency in between when a lot of people will just look at a spreadsheet and they'll say, okay, there's 10 million traffic here, there's only 3 million traffic here, but maybe the 3 million in traffic is doing real journalism. I mean, there's investment, they're sending correspondents, people are putting their lives on the line. And, you know, how does that company, though, sustain? And how do we get that message across? Because right now, I think, as you said, we're in an early day and people just want to measure numbers. Yeah, and if the quality of journalism is great, it doesn't really matter. I still want to go for the high traffic. How are we going to get this message across to the media landscape, but also, of course, to the end, to the user to pay for this?
I think...
I know it's a magic question, but...
No. Actually, I try to answer it very concretely. I think you have to make a decision whether you are in the reach business or in the engagement business.
Will the agency understand that?
Yeah,
The 22-year-old who is looking at a spreadsheet, who's very, very far away from the brand manager of Audi or whoever it is.
No, they definitely will. I mean, let's take our biggest brand, biggest legacy brand, Bild. The average time spent of Bild is, I think, 5 times higher than the time spent of the second biggest digital news brand in Germany. The direct traffic is, I think, at the moment around 80%. So 80% of the people go directly to the brand. They do not come via smart SEO and search engines. They really go to the brand because they like the brand. That is, for an advertising client, a pretty easy message to understand. Do I really want to be in a brand context where people occasionally end up because they are led by a search engine to that site where they have no relationship to? Or do I go to a site that may have smaller traffic figures, but very loyal readers who trust that brand and, of course, trust also to a certain degree the messages that are sent from commercial players, from advertising clients in that context? That was also true in the old analog days. It is not only about the figures in the spreadsheet. It is also about the quality of a target group, and it is about the loyalty of a target group. And I think we have also to take into account this whole new development of paid models, of paid content. I mean, in the analog world, we had the free sheet newspapers that were at the front of every household. Nobody took took them serious, advertising prices were 15 times lower than those per 1,000 readers of a paid paper. And I think the same will be true in the internet. So let's say 5 to 7 years from now, we will have a distinction. We will have some commodity sites with free content. People read it occasionally. They play a role. They are fine. They have high reach figures. We have others with lower reach figures, but a very loyal and sophisticated target group, high time spends, and then, of course, high advertising spend. So I think it is a question of habits that are going to develop. I'm not pessimistic.
Excellent. Herr Dufin, Dankeschön.
Thank you.
Thank you. You've been listening to The Big Interview with me, Tyler Brulé, in conversation with Matthias Dupfner. The Big Interview is produced and edited by Bill Luthi and researched by Gaia Lutz. Don't forget to subscribe to this and any of our other programs on Monocle 24. They can be found on iTunes, SoundCloud, and of course, monocle.com. Until next time, many thanks from all of us here at Midori House in London. Goodbye.